Well, welcome everybody to the first of our seminars in the study of mysticism this time. I'm very, very pleased indeed to welcome Lance Cousins, who's going to give us a talk today. Lance is an expert in Buddhism, particularly Pali Buddhism. He's an expert in the Pali commentary literature and the Abhidhamma, and he has a deep, deep knowledge of meditation traditions in Buddhism. So we're very pleased indeed to welcome him to us today. And he's going to speak an intriguing title, Flowing Milk, A Lost Meditation Tradition from the Silk Road. Lance.
Okay. There you go. The Eastern Silk Roads. What is commonly known as the Silk Road, it refers to a complex of trade routes, which from at least the 2nd century BC, and probably much earlier, directly linked the civilizations of the Iranians and Hellenistic Greeks with those of China and the Indian subcontinent, and indirectly creates secondary trading connections with Europe and Africa to the one side, and Southeast Asia to the other. It's a map. It's fairly clear. You can see the context from up on the left. Where we are eventually going to come to, I don't think the biro will. This is sort of where I'm pointing. You might be able to read Kaisel. That's actually the place we're going to be concerned. Anyway, I've got more maps because the context we're concerned with is what's usually called the northern route. It looks like the middle route in this particular one. And this actually represents a time somewhat later than the time of the manuscript I'm going to be talking about. And here's a closer up. Now again you can see Kaisel right in the middle up and up the top next to Kuchar. That's just so it locates it in relation to modern boundaries for you. I rather like maps, so I've ended up with more maps than I really need, you see. And there's another one as well. If you like them. Takes us back to an earlier period. In the present context, we may note that from around the 1st century BC, if not somewhat earlier, Buddhism began to spread along the Silk Road from Afghanistan northwards into Bactria and Sogdia, and eastwards along the trade routes both north and south of the Taklamakan Desert, which is the area in a different colour, sort of in the middle, sort of below, just below this, in the middle. Yeah. So it's surrounded by a ring. We do not really know when this process began. There's no reason to suppose that the first Buddhist travellers along this route would have left any literary, historical, or archaeological record. We know about the process only after it has gathered a sufficient momentum to attract the support of wealthy donors and kings. By then, of course, it may already have been in decline. What is in any case certain is that during the middle centuries of the first millennium AD, Buddhist monasteries and shrines were to be found scattered along the Eastern Silk Road routes and constituted what must have been an important cultural unifying force linking these territories with areas to the south in present-day northern Afghanistan, northern Pakistan, and northwestern India, where Buddhist centres have been established from around the 3rd century BC. Give or take. Buddhist monasticism remained a significant force in many parts of this large region, at least until the coming of Islam, and in some parts down to the 14th century. There's an older map that somebody made, something like Wallerstein published. The area in red, Kuchar, the little kingdom of Kuchar, is the area we'll be concerned with. The later history of Buddhism in Central Asia does not concern us now. It is enough to note that when European interest in the antiquities of this area began to develop in the 19th century, the region contained numerous sites of great interest. The dry climate preserved both art historical and textual antiquities in large numbers from a period significantly more than a millennium ago. Of course, This included much non-Buddhist material too, Nestorian Christian, Manichaean Gnostic, and Zoroastrian, to name but three. But our interest is with the spectacular discoveries of objects of Buddhist origin, and in particular with one area and with one specific text from that area. Awareness of Central Asia as a possible source of well-preserved antiquities developed gradually over the last decades of the 19th century. The successful journeys of Sven Hedin, starting in the 1890s in what was then known as Eastern Turkestan, resulted in a series of expeditions to the area mounted or funded by learned academies, governments, and wealthy individuals. In this country, those associated with the name of Sir Aurel Sein are especially well known, but at least seven countries sent out such missions, and their acquisitions are stored in more than a dozen museums and libraries around the world. Our concern today is specifically with the results of the expedition sent out from Berlin, and particularly with the third expedition which worked in the Kutchar region. This four-man expedition was under the charge of Albert Grünwedel and Albert von Lecoq, although the library or bookstore in which our manuscript was found was the discovery of Theodor Bartas. So come. Bartas, there he is on the right, a native of Lassan on the River Oder in western Pomerania, had been a sailor and qualified pilot on a sailing vessel for many years, and then a landholder in Australia until he lost his savings in a bank crash. Very topical. He then took up employment with the Berlin Ethnological Museum, and was the only person to take part in all four of the German and Prussian Turfan expeditions. It is clear that it was his practical skills which were in many ways the mainstay of these ventures. As you see, there's Albert von Lecoq on the left, and the local potentate is sitting in the middle, and some of his, flunkies sitting behind. Early in 1906, while the team was working in Kaisel, I have no idea how to pronounce Kaisel, there are various spellings with various diacritics, and sometimes beginning with K and sometimes with Q. So I shall say Kaisel. If somebody can correct me, or Frederick can probably offer the Chinese name. That's what I'll say anyway. It's 36 kilometres to the northwest of the town of Kutchar. Bartas came across a library in which various birch bark manuscripts were found, and in particular a small room with some stone bookshelves covered with a dense layer of rather decayed manuscript material. It was from here that the main part of our meditation manual was retrieved. There's an older map, but of East Pakistan, and there you can see Kutchar up in the top centre, just north of the Tarim. And Kaisel is there, beginning with a Q, but it's a little bit to the northwest. It's slightly difficult to read because it's at a tilt and partly obscured.
Under the N.
Too late, I'm afraid. Here's a plan of Kaisel, anyway, with some diacritics. The exact place where the manuscript was found is shown by the arrow. For what it is worth. And I will show you some pictures of the scenery a little bit later on. So the manuscript material. Because of the state of the main manuscript and the unfamiliarity of its contents, it was not until 1964 that an edition and German translation of the text was published by Dieter Schlingoff, with a facsimile volume following 2 years later. Since no title for the work is known, he referred to it as the Yoga Lehrbuch, and it is now usually referred to by that name, even in English. For the purpose of today's lecture, I shall simply call it the Meditation Manual. The principal manuscript is on birch bark and dates from the 7th century. There it is. Oh, that is one leaf. Two sides of one leaf. For his edition, Professor Schlingloff could also make use of three fragments from paper manuscripts of similar date. There's one of them. It's in a form of Brahmi alphabet, so some of you might be able to read it. It begins Tvam iti karuna on the top left. Tvam iti karuna. If you know some Brahmi, I wonder if you might. Two of these were found together with the birch bark manuscript, these paper manuscripts, and one from a location slightly further east at Shorchuk, or whatever. Working with this material, Schlingloff was able to restore what he estimated to be about 42% of the text. In fact, however, because the Meditation Manual applies a similar methodology to various topics, we can probably form a sufficient idea of the bulk of its contents, so I'm constantly dissatisfied with questions which I would like answers and on bits that are missing. A small amount of additional material has surfaced since 1966. In particular, we can note some further pieces of a paper manuscript preserved in the Pelliot collection in Paris, dating from a slightly later period. These appear to have come from nearby Duldur Akur and have been edited by Noble Yoshi Yamabe. The references to these things are on the bibliographic handout. The Hernler collection of the British Library also contains at least five small fragments, which have been variously edited by Jens Ove Hartmann and by Karashima and Villa. And here, in fact, is one of the fragments from the British Library. I mean, it's just pretty small, but it's all evidence for a number of copies of this text having been current, which is my interest. This one begins Pahaya Prabhicha Vitaka Rahito. The provenance is certainly somewhere in the Kuchar area. The Meditation Manual itself has recently been reprinted, I mean Schlingloff's edition in German translation, with additional material by Hartmann and others, again on the bibliography. It seems then that we have definite evidence of the existence of at least four copies, and possibly more, of the Meditation Manual in the Kuchar region around the 7th and 8th centuries. This is important because it suggests that the text had at least some currency in Central Asia, although we have no Indian reference to its methods, and no Chinese translation appears to have existed, or if one was made, it has been lost. This means that we must work out by inference from other materials found in the same area and by analysis of the contents of the manual exactly how it fits into the history of Buddhism in general and of Buddhist meditation in particular. Schlingloff himself suggested that, like other works found in the same location, it must have been a work of the Sarvastivadin school, in which case it would derive from their centres in Kashmir and the region around Mathura. He also felt that it showed no definite signs of Mahayana Buddhist doctrine. Others see a more definite Mahayana element and a possible origin in Central Asia itself. I may return to the issue of whether it is Mahayana or not Mahayana at the end of this time. It is, however, unlikely that they would have had sufficient knowledge of Sanskrit in this area to compose such a text without prior Indian models. That's my own view. So my suspicion is, in fact, this is a text originating from India, from the northwest. But there's no way of proving it. We do know that monks from Kumarajiva is a famous example. Monks from precisely Kuchar, where Kumarajiva came from, he went and studied in Kashmir for a longish period and was there converted to the Mahayana. a fact with great consequences for the subsequent history of Buddhism in China. And he probably wasn't the only one. So there's no reason why people wouldn't have learned. I think if you go to study Buddhism in Kashmir at that date, you would have had to have been fluent in Sanskrit, because the teaching would have been in Sanskrit, and you would have been expected to speak Sanskrit, and let alone write it. Yeah. So that means you cannot rule out the possibility that they would have known Sanskrit well enough to write something of their own. But they are working very much from the tradition. So if the text is composed there, I suspect it has exemplars from India that we don't know. If it isn't indeed, in fact, Indian. It's also been pointed out that the presence of a number of copies of a text of this kind, one closely connected to the actual practice of meditation, probably evidences actual living practice of meditation among the monks living here. This is a very tricky subject. Does a text that talks about experience actually act as evidence? Or is it evidence that people actually had the experience? And in general, among scholars, you find that those who don't meditate, don't belong to the experiential side of things, tend to think it doesn't. And those who do meditate and do belong to the experiential side of things tend to think that it does. And I would guess that probably in some cases it does, and in some cases it doesn't. Since he's diplomatically following the Buddhist midway. This is particularly clear at Kaizong. Now we look at the place. So it's rather old. There's Kaizong in the early 20th century. I can't locate where the place our manuscript was found is, but it was in the western part, somewhere in there. Here's the eastern part. Gives you an idea of the sort of place it is. And here's another slightly bitter photograph, again of the eastern part, with a possible cow, or two cows, to give you a size comparison. We may suppose that cave dwellings of this kind typically begin as the habitation of relatively ascetic, practice-orientated monks. Another picture of the scenery around here. There's our friend Bartus again up the top with some labourers. Again, gives you a size comparison. Up on the left. In India, we might perhaps speak of forest dwellers or forest-dwelling monks. Any such centre is liable to acquire a reputation for sanctity and eventually become a resort for pilgrims and those seeking respite from the troubles of ordinary life. Probably in its heyday, it looked more like this. These are more modern photographs, best I've been able to find, of what it's like now. But oddly enough, I think it probably was more like that in its heyday, with buildings in front and so on, which have long gone.
So there's still monks living there,
you say, like that? I don't know the people, I don't know, it's just photographs. Oh, well, I assume it's mainly a tourist track nowadays. I do not know. I have not been able to go there. Once you have pilgrims and a wider range of visitors, you need to have something to show them, and you must create opportunities for them to earn merit by donations on both a small scale and a large scale. Not surprisingly, you see the creation of shrines, sculpture and painting, both on perishable materials and on those of a more durable kind. In India, and for that matter in most other locations, wood and textiles and the like usually do not survive. Whereas here in Central Asia, some of it does prove amazingly long-lasting under desert conditions. This undoubtedly tells us much which we would otherwise not know about the appearance of many Buddhist centres elsewhere at this time. Of particular interest in this case are the paintings. The meditation manual has a strong emphasis on visualization, and it does not seem too far-fetched to suppose that there may be some connection between the content of the paintings and many of the elements which occur in the visualizations. So I'll show you just a few to get a sense of it, but it's quite wonderful stuff, and it's well worth looking at and exploring if you've never seen any. So here's a couple of monks. Now we definitely have two monks. I can't stop too long over these, unfortunately. As you see, they're quite colourful paintings. And then slide. Oh yes, they look like Buddhas to me. And then there are many of these wall paintings. This is what's often called the Seaman's Cave. I suspect this is a Jataka. I haven't attempted to find out whether anybody has yet identified it or what Jataka it would be, but it has the look of that kind of thing, or Avadharma. The little piece on the left is, I think, of particular interest. And what is that fellow doing in that odd-seated posture with his legs crossed, his hands crossed? Well, he looks very ascetic. And what's that thing above his head? It all seems to me to be much to do with the actual subject matter of our meditation manual, but it's hard to prove that. Particularly when both that and the meditation manual are incomplete.
Is that a boat? Is it?
Sorry.
Seaman's Cave because it was a boat? Or?
I think so, yes. I mean, there's definitely a seaman around somewhere. I haven't paid a lot of attention. This is only a part of it, obviously.
It's a cave.
A cave.
A cave.
Mm. Yes, but there is a seaman in that cave, in representation one, but I don't see it in that slide. And this is the Buddha's cremation, of course, as I said. It's fairly sort of colourful representation again.
Interesting cloth he's wrapped in,
then. Isn't it? Yes. Yes. Well, he was, the body was wound around in various ways before cremation in the textual accounts, with highly precious materials and so on. So this may be a way of representing that. We may then suppose that the meditation manual represents a tradition of practice, most probably originating in Kashmir or a nearby area, one which is spread along the more northern of the two main routes between China and India. And one should mention that very, very little of Mahayana texts, very, very few Mahayana texts have ever been found along the northern route. Many have been found along the southern route. So it's generally assumed that the centres to the north of the Taklamakan are probably Sarvastivadin and certainly non-Mahayanist, for a long period through the heyday in Central Asia, and conversely Mahayana seems to have been triumphant from a relatively early date further to the south, and many Mahayanist or parts of Mahayanist manuscripts have been found there, for what that's worth. As I said, this locates us spatially, but I've not so far addressed the exact date. It's important to recall that the date of the manuscript is, of course, not at all the same as the date of the work which it contains. Indeed, it's likely to be quite a bit earlier than the 7th century. Nothing in the content that I've been able to read would seem to rule out a date before the 4th century AD, and it may well be some centuries older than that. For this, we need to look at the contents of the manual and its place in the general development of Buddhist meditation. I should add, I'd be surprised if it were BC in date. There are little mentions to technical details of Sarvastivadin thinking, which you wouldn't expect to find as early as that. So it's that period from the first to the fourth looks to me to be the area, the type period we're looking for, but there's no way to narrow it down more than that, I would think. The structure of the meditation manual. The basic structure of the meditation manual consists of some 15 exercises which can usefully be listed under five headings. Here we go. And in fact, I'll give it in a table, but I'll also state it briefly. So parts are missing. We don't know what meditation on the unpleasant is to counteract. We don't know what breathing mindfulness, according to this manual, is to counteract. I have more to say on that. Nor do we know it for the first of the four things I've put under elements. We do know it for aggregates, which is to counteract the view that there exists a self, the Atma-drishti. Meditation on the spheres is to counteract thirst for existence and objects of enjoyment. These are all statements in the text itself. That's bhava-bhoga-trishna. Conditioned origination is to counteract delusion or ignorance. And then compassion, goes to the immeasurables, loving-kindness. Says something about being due to the removal of another's happiness and welfare, which I don't quite understand the cause, but mainly it's to counteract cruelty, vihinsa, and delighting in another's suffering, paradukha priti. And then meditation on gladness or joy in the joys of others is to counteract envy and boredom. It's to counteract the failure to delight in other people's happiness. And again, it repeats the statement about envy and boredom. And meditation on equanimity is to counteract sensual passion and ill will, karma raga, via pada. And unfortunately, the ones I most would like to know are the last ones, and they are precisely the ones that are missing. It has to be noted that we have neither the precise beginning of the work nor its conclusion, so we do not know for certain whether there might have been one or two more topics of recollection at the end. There could even have been some entirely additional subjects, but that seems improbable. Although we can view this as a list of 15 distinct methods of meditation, counting the things I have in ABCD, as we shall see, it seems more likely that this should be grouped under the five headings, as I have done. Simply a list, the number of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 9. It's clear that the text originally listed what specific mental obstacles each of these 15 exercises is designed to counteract, but as I said, those from the beginning and end are mostly missing at present. And here, now we see it spelt out. And here we see the left. From other sources, it's not difficult to guess what the first two would have been, since meditation on the unpleasant is commonly given as counteracting some kind of greed or attachment, while breathing mindfulness is frequently referred to as the cure for discursive thinking. Very little has been written in English about the meditation manual, but one notable exception is an article by David Rueg, published in 1967. It's in the bibliography there. In it, he refers to earlier work by Demierville and points out the existence of a number of sources in Chinese which mention five gates. Most, but not all, loosely correspond to the five headings given here. Rueg seems to see a possible connection between these lists and the specific influence of the famous early 5th century translator Kumarajiva, who was, as I said earlier, himself a native of Kuchaha. This may be so, But let us note here that such lists are much older and likely to have been shared by most, if not all, Buddhist schools. Already such notions are found in canonical texts which belong to earlier strata of the Pali Canon. For example, in the Itivutaka we read, one quotation, "Dwell contemplating the unpleasant in the body, monks, and let breathing mindfulness be well established by you within around the face. Dwell contemplating impermanence in all constructed things. The underlying tendency towards attachment, which is found in pleasing things, is abandoned by those who dwell contemplating the unpleasant in the body. When breathing mindfulness is well established within around the face, external inclinations towards thinking, which are associated with distress, do not occur. For those who dwell contemplating impermanence in all constructed things, ignorance is abandoned and knowledge arises." So here in a text which probably predates the arrival of Buddhism in Central Asia, we already have the first two or three of our five headings. In actuality, meditation on impermanence is closely linked to the exercises I have grouped under that third heading. Even closer, in another early text, the Udana, we have, "The unpleasant should be practiced in order to abandon attachment. Loving kindness should be practiced in order to abandon ill will. Breathing mindfulness should be practiced to cut off thinking. The recognition of impermanence should be practiced in order to root out pride in what one is. For Megya, one who recognizes impermanence firmly establishes recognition of no self. One who recognizes no self achieves the rooting out of pride in what one is, Nibbana in this very life." Nibbana or Nibbana. This passage is also found in the Anguttara Nikaya. So in the Udana and Anguttara Nikaya, we have the first of the immeasurables or divine abidings, the Brahma Vihara, in fourth place. We should understand that the practice of loving kindness leads automatically into the practice of compassion, joy in the joys of others, and equanimity. So the single mention of loving kindness automatically implies the full set of the four immeasurables. The negative qualities which each of them counteract are also found in canonical Pali texts. And indeed, one equally early discourse in the Rajanikaya, addressed to the Buddha's son Rahula, adds both the other three immeasurables and four qualities which they counteract. What is notably absent in all these sources is the set of exercises placed under our fifth heading, the recollections. That is all the more surprising when we note that both lists of 10 and 6 recollections are found in Pali canonical works and in parallel texts in Chinese. Of course, the full list of 10 recollections could not be used here, because breathing mindfulness, which is one of the 10 recollections, has already been included as the second exercise. Again, we should not be surprised that some later lists give only the first recollection, recollection of the Buddha. This would be seen as leading naturally into the others. It may be that the recollection of the Buddha represents a somewhat later element in the older literature, but in any case it certainly precedes both the development of Mahayana literature and the likely introduction of Buddhism to Central Asia. Its addition to lists of meditation practices related to negative qualities which they counteract is found only in one of the latest texts of the Pali Canon, the Nidesa. This is best presented as a table. There we go. The context is a description of the way in which the Buddha adjusts his teaching for individuals of 6 different character types. Here we can ignore the third item, which is not precisely a type of meditation exercise in the usual sense. One kind of scarf, what on earth the word meditation really means in the context of Indian thought. What remains is a set of 5 topics which reasonably correspond to the 5 headings of our meditation manual. infer from all this that the general outline of the manual follows a traditional pattern, which is likely to be rather earlier than the date of the manual itself, and almost certainly precedes the creation of Mahayana literature in the form in which we know it. The intention of the authors of this manual itself is certainly to present the 15 topics as a logical progression through which the meditator gradually advances. I do not intend to suggest that its contents are necessarily as early as that. The manual does, as I mentioned, contain occasional references to elements or stages of the Buddhist path which are known to us mainly from Sarvastivadin sources and may belong to the earlier centuries AD. That said, we have little knowledge of other schools in Kashmir and neighbouring areas at this time. We know from inscriptions that they were there. We do not know how far such ideas were shared among different schools. So I turn now to the actual content of our meditation manual. What we find is a rather elaborate visualization procedure, as a kind of technique which can be applied to each of the 15 types of meditative exercise. In using the term visualization, I do not distinguish between an exercise for the purpose of seeing something and the spontaneous occurrence of something seen which is subsequently described. In practice, it is often not possible to distinguish between these two possibilities. A great deal of fairly vivid imagery is used. Many of the elements of this imagery occur regularly in early Indian art, Buddhist and non-Buddhist. To give some examples, vases used to sprinkle nectar or pour other liquids, lion thrones, makaras, crocodile-like figures, vajra thrones, caves, standards, vajra, parasols, elephants, lions, hanksas, these sort of ones, lotus flowers and ponds, wish-granting jewels, jewel trees, jewel flowers, jeweled wheels, jeweled palaces, crystal, barrel, diamond, and other precious stones. It's colourful stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Conch shells, pearls, shrine halls, I call them, kutagara. The four colours, blue, yellow, red, and white. Pools and showers of oil, streams of flowers, jewels, foam, bubbles, and so on. Moon and sun discs, nakshatras. So just to remind us of all this colourfulness, go back to see some small things. Getting bored with all this talking. As an apsaras and a gandharva. those who fancy a trip to heaven. And here we have our Garuda again, or another one. I think the resonances here are with the kind of accounts of the Naga and the Garuda that you get in Buddhist literature, rather than with the Garuda and later connected to Vishnu, of course. Famously in the Mahasamaya Sutta, we have a key pair of verses which emphasizes the fact that the Nagas and the Garudas are always at war, and they find peace only in the presence of the Buddha. And there are two opposing qualities.
So are they at peace there or war?
Good question.
Mm.
And what it's trying to represent, it's two-headed, which is interesting. Mm. And there appear to be two Nagas. And you do wonder whether there are other things being indicated as well, but... there's another one. They seem to like to tie them together down around where we might think of as the name. And then some of them are more These are just ones I happen to like that I happen to have slides on, shall I say. This is the drawing of a banner. This is a drawing that has been made. I'll show you the photograph in a moment. Which is actually the four main events in the life of the Buddha. So if you look from the left, the bottom left, you have the birth. That is Maya standing. And above you have what is probably the Enlightenment. And down bottom right you have the what must be the first sermon, because we've got two deer there and it's in the deer park. And a very interesting representation of that wheel symbol. You can't see it too well. In being linked here with the first sermon. And above that we have the Mahaparinibbana. The drawing makes it a little easier to see, but in fact it's a fairly good representation, as you can see from the photograph. And it makes you imagine that India must have been full of colourful banners of this kind in this period. And of course, nothing of this kind survives from any religious tradition.
Who's holding the banner?
I do not know who he is. Is he a Buddha? Or is he a god? He might be a bodhisattva, actually. He's got earrings, so he probably isn't a Buddha at this date. But I do not know. I'm not really expert in this art, this isn't my interest. But it's just nice to get this context for which it all belongs. And this is where this appears. And there's the banner up on the top, you see. It's part of a larger picture. And it would say up on the top left, yes, it's called the Maya Cave, this one. Isn't it, because of the representation of Maya there. The names are a little bit call it something. Nor is this, now going back to our text, this is just a diversion.
Keep
you amused, yes. Nor is this imagery static, were you amused, Peggy? It is regularly extended in space. I do. It is regularly extended in space, both within the body and outwards from various locations on the body. Horizontally to the seas and continents of traditional Buddhist cosmology and beyond, and vertically to various lower and higher realms. It is also extended backwards in time to the six past Buddhas, and into the future with Maitreya, the Buddha to come. The visions are also peopled with deities and divine beings from the same worldview, notably Brahma and Indra, craters, heavenly nymphs and Garudas. We find two visions containing numerous bodhisattvas and Buddhas, although no others are given names. I should mention here that sort of multiple Buddhas and so on is not an indication of being Mahayanist. We have to be careful of that. Not in this period. Some of the imagery is more unusual. Let us note the sending out of streams made up of imagined portions of the body, bones, flesh, bodily organs, and various unattractive liquids, which I will leave to your imagination. Or on the more pleasing side, milk trees and milk pillars, streams, seas and pools of milk. So you visualize flows of milk arising from some part of the body and extending across the cosmos and then returning again and so on. So you become part of a connection with the whole of the whole of the cosmos, the levels above, the things below, backwards in time, forwards in time, and so on. It's a remarkable business, really. Particularly notable is the frequent occurrence of visual images referred to as nimittas, which are specifically explained as representations of particular qualities. I will come back to them a little bit, at least, if I have time. Yamabe has drawn attention to the resemblances between much of this imagery and that which occurs in a number of texts found in Chinese from the 5th century AD. Some of these are believed to be Central Asian creations from the Turfan area. This, in all honesty, is always a guess. We know so little about what was going on in India in this period, and we know so much more about what's going on in Central Asia, that whenever anyone tries to attribute anything going to China as coming from Central Asia, it may be correct, but it is never better than a guess. This is an important thing to remember. We simply have far too little knowledge of the amount of variation there was in Indian Buddhism, and particularly at this time, to be able to tell with certainty. But that's, I'm not in any way ruling out the possibility that Central Asians were creative and produced their own forms of Buddhism. Of course they may have done. So Yamabe's view associates our meditation manual with Mahayana. Although this work clearly lacks many of the most typical features of the developed Mahayana, I've already mentioned the absence of large numbers of named Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. The exception was Maitreya, who of course is the one named Buddha, future Buddha, who is shared by all schools of Buddhism. We can note also the complete absence of the philosophical side of the Mahayana. Neither the emptiness teachings of the perfection of wisdom literature, nor what we can call the mentalism of the Yogacara school. I'm not sure I should use that expression. The presence of an aspiration to become a Buddha is, of course, not distinctive of the Mahayana. A similar position to Yamabe is taken in a more detailed recent study by Sven Bretfeld, again in the bibliographical list. I find myself in disagreement. It seems to me that the world of the meditation manual is rather that of the art of Barhut and Sanche and of the latest texts in the Pali canon. It seems to me to represent the common Buddhist tradition around the beginning of the Christian era or a little earlier, a tradition from which both later Mahayana and the southern Buddhist tradition develop in different ways. And there are no doubt there are many other traditions that develop from that as well that don't survive. I would see the meditation manual then as continuing an older tradition of meditation. This might either be because it was preserved or written among followers of a tradition which rejected the newer Mahayana developments, or because the core of the text dates back to an earlier period. To justify this, I turn to the history of visualization in the Pali texts. There's in fact quite a large body of material in the early Pali texts related to the visual, both in specifically meditational context and in the use of imagery related to light and colour. There's not time to survey that today, so I will confine myself to mentioning a few of the more relevant examples. In the Upakilesa Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, we find specific mention of the need to see both light and visual forms in meditation. Unbalanced if you see only one. This is sufficient to show that some visual element was present in meditation from a relatively early date. Some years ago, I gave a lecture in London in which I discussed the use of directional symbolism in the Pali tradition. I never got round to giving that in Oxford. This included such things as the use of the analogy of the directions to structure the universe of social relations, or to establish a sense of protection by non-human beings, as well as examples of meditational use, notably to spread loving kindness and similar qualities to living beings in the different directions. I pointed also to the closely related use of the directions and the number four, as well as of sets of colours or precious materials, to enhance visualization practices. Under this heading, we look rather briefly at some materials related to the traditional Indian cosmology of the Central Mountain and four continents, and also the use of animals in this context. Perhaps the oldest example of this kind of use is to be found in the Mahasudassana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. Here we have many sets of four and seven as part of the descriptions of the city and palace of the Chakravartin king or universal monarch, named very fair to behold, Mahasudasana. So, for example, the first set of four gives the gates of the city as made of gold, silver, beryl, or you can say lapis lazuli, and crystal. By way of comparison, the seven walls of the city are made of gold, silver, beryl, crystal, ruby, emerald, and every kind of jewel. Again, very colourful stuff. Similarly, the lotus ponds constructed around the city had tiles and stairways, either of gold or silver or beryl or crystal, while the balustrades of the stairways had pillars of the same material, but crossbars and copings of an opposing material, paired as gold and silver or beryl and crystal. The description of the monarch's palace of Dhamma, constructed for him by the Deva Visakama, Vishvakarman, in Sanskrit, follows dissimilar lines. The tiles, the 84,000 pillars, the seats, the 24 stairways, the 84,000 chambers, and the trees inscribed on the doorways are all of the same four materials. The lotus pond, also named Dhamma, that's Pali for Dharma, which the king had constructed in front of the palace, is similarly described. These descriptions are clearly the literary source of important elements in the descriptions of wondrous pure lands found in many Mahayana sutras, most notably the Sukhavati Vyoha. The link between such descriptions and contemplating the idealized form of the Buddha as a meditation topic is, of course, well known at a later date. The forefathers of the southern tradition do not go quite as far as this, but there are some sources which are clearly moving in that direction. One sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya describes how the Buddha manifests himself above a Brahma deity, seated cross-legged in the air and meditating upon the fire element. In other words, manifesting flames, as the commentary explains. Four of the great Arahat disciples then do likewise, taking up positions to the east, south, west, and north successively. This clearly foreshadows much material in the Mahayana sources. A rather later canonical text, the Patisambhida Magga, refers explicitly to suffusing a small or large space with blue or yellow or red or white. One Pali text included in the Southern Buddhist canon, although certainly one of the last texts to be included there, does go somewhat further. This is a Kudaka Nikaya text known as the Apadana. This text has not yet been translated and has not been much studied until recently. Its first chapter gives a visualization practice commencing with the mental construction of a palace, which is subsequently peopled with Buddhas and Pacheka Buddhas to whom offerings are made. It is noticeable that the description of the palace has a number of features in common with the palace of the universal monarch very fair to behold, most notably in its stories of beryl and gold and coral. And a later chapter gives a virtual apotheosis of the Buddha's former wife Yasodhara, in which just before her death, she transforms herself into a bird-like shape after the fashion of the universe, i.e. the parts of her body represent the four continents, as is stated. So there are some things that are there, actually, which, not a full development of these kinds of things, but you can see that these are the seeds from which all of this comes and may be the kind of literary reminders of a lot of things that were actually going on in the forests and meditation centres, even at a much earlier date, that haven't necessarily got into our texts. So, turning to the Yoga Lea book, just a reminder that the whole thing may have a much older antiquity. It has seeds in an earlier period. I do not wish to say that everything that we have was there. Just talk now to finish one or two rather more specific things in this manual, which is very colourful and very varied, and if there were time one would read some of it, but I decided not to do that this time. But I want to mention one or two things. One of the things that's very striking about it is the use of locations on the body. This is quite interesting, of course, in the context of the current discussion, of which there seems to be a lot going on about the antiquity of the chakra system and so on. But here, at least, and in a text of the 7th century, that's to say the manuscript is dates to the 7th century, let alone the age of the contents. Now, these visualizations, the things are constantly happening in relation to places in the body. So something flows out, maybe to the top of through the different heaven realms, or out to the boundary of the of this world system, the chakravarta, and so on, and then returns and comes in through another specific location in the body. And the ones that are given are quite interesting. You have the head, the forehead, the place in the centre between the eyebrows. You have the throat. And then you have the fingers of both hands. And it's difficult to know what that means without knowing what position, what posture they were using. And then we have... Well, you could take it, we have the navel. It's a natural place for things to flow out of, I suppose, or flow in through. And we have what they call the makara, which they say is between the big toe and the adjacent toe. And it's not quite clear what they mean. I assume they're talking about people who are sitting in a cross-legged posture. Right? And if you imagine that these are the big toes of the legs of the feet, it could mean this area, but perhaps it means the area in there, back of my beard. Okay, it's somewhat like a makara, a crocodile form. Of course, in the Indian art from the ancient period, you see on the ends of things, you see these crocodile figures all the time. Now, so, and they sometimes simply say that they flow back in and out through all the bodily orifices. And that may mean these things, or it may mean one of the standard lists of orifices, which you get. This is not precisely the same as the kind of thing you get with the centres. Just as the kind of thing you get in Buddhist texts translated into Tibetan in the... before the end of the first millennium AD is not precisely the same as any specific chakra system, but you're in the same general area, it seems to me, and that's interesting. No. And then another thing that's particularly characteristic of this text, and I think unusual and interesting, is they talk about nimittas all the time. Now, the word nimitta is, in Sanskrit and Pali, it's identical. Can have a lot of meanings, of course. It can mean a portent, it can mean a sign in a very ordinary way. It can mean an image, and a whole range of other things. But it is often used very specifically for the things that you see or experience or are objects of meditation. But here, it's within the context of a visualization method. And the things that you see are explicitly stated to represent things. And this is rather more unusual, and I don't know anything else that quite does it, so I will give you some examples. You see a young boy, it represents the chitta, the mind. If you see a conch cell or eye sockets, it represents the space element. If you see a monkey, or if you see a spotted antelope or a torch, it represents the consciousness element. If you see a barrel woman, it represents mindfulness. If you see a man, it represents clear comprehension. This is a pair in Buddhist thinking, mindfulness and clear comprehension. Satisampajanya in Pali. If you see a golden woman dressed in white, it represents compassion. If you see a shining golden and joyful woman, it represents mudita, joy in the joys of others. If you see a man and woman dressed in white, it represents the two qualities in Sanskrit, hri and avatrapya, shame and regard for, concern for consequence, moral consequence, the guardians of the world, as the Buddhist texts call them. If you see eight Buddha images on lion thrones, it represents the Eightfold Path. If you see a woman with a lamp in hand, it represents knowledge. You left me with a feeling that Carl Jung would have loved this text. I've been able to read it.
An interesting question is whether people's experience is determined by the fact there's a list of things they might experience.
Well, this is a question that we can discuss. I mean, and that's why I'm very careful. Is it telling us what we should experience, setting up a pattern for us to try to conform to, or is it saying that you will experience these things? Or is it somewhere in between the two? My suspicion is actually somewhere in between the two. If you're working within a tradition, it develops expectations. But it isn't perhaps as it would be, say, with some kinds of tantric practice, where you have a set of very specific things you visualize. This seems to me to be a much more fluid kind of way of doing it, in general, what's being described here. But I wouldn't pretend to know very much about all the different kinds of tantric and meditation practices that have existed in India alone, let alone the rest of Asia as well. So there may well be cases that are very like this. No. All this is within the context of a kind of constant movement, or a better way of putting it, that's what I put first of all, and then I changed my mind, because you go out to somewhere, or you go down through the Mount Meru, through the levels below, down to the sphere of the winds. This is the traditional cosmology as the Sarvastivadins present it. And you come back again. So that's constant movement. But every so often, it seems to come to a point of stillness, either by focusing back to a point or becoming immersed in a pool of something or other. Seem to be the two ways of doing it. So it's a constant movement between stillness and a very active form of visualization experience. And this, of course, is quite, later on, quite characteristic of some kinds of tantric practice, I would think. All sorts of other things here. And all sorts of experiences occur, I mean, including lots of things. I've written here, besprinkled with showers of oil. It's just one example. There's lots more about milk, by the way. And abhishekha of various kinds. Sprinkling is always abhishekha, I suppose, but more specifically stated to be abhishekha sometimes. And then towards the end of the text, we get a kind of culmination, and we do have a prediction in vision of Buddhahood for the person meditating. And this is probably one of the reasons, we also have emphasis on developing the great compassion. It's probably one of the reasons why people want to say this is a Mahayanist text. They forget that non-Mahayanists may still aspire to be Buddhas. It's maybe from a Mahayana doctrinal point of view, they would then be Mahayanists, but they wouldn't be from their own point of view. So, you know, from a historical point of view, it becomes a very fine question. I'll go on a bit, if I may, because we're very near to the end. Mm. And the issue becomes even in way more interesting, and it's come home to me particularly just this last month, an article in Eastern Buddhist by Ingo Strauch, same place as the one I sent you, but a different one, where he gives rather detailed account of this, an early text from the Akshobhya tradition. This is one of the new discoveries from Gandhara in Gandhari Prakrit. And it's closely related to the Akshobhya Vyuha in Chinese, but it's not the same. And it really does seem to represent, and his answer was very interesting on this, a Mahayana before the Mahayana. As you know, so the whole question becomes very difficult. Is it Mahayanist or not Mahayanist? It's quite clear what the Mahayana comes from, but it has not broken off from other forms of Buddhism. It's still very positive about arahats, for example. That's just one example. There are a number of other features of that kind. And It might be that this text also goes back to that period, that it's right at the period where the Mahayanist tradition has not branched off from non-Mahayanist forms of Buddhism in the way that they clearly do a century or two later. In which case, we probably can't answer the question whether this text is Mahayanist or not, because it's going to be purely a matter of definition, how we define what we mean. That's always a good place to stop. So, I put this in because I rather like it. Mm. It's a drawing of it. And it... Is it the first sermon? It looks like the first sermon to me. And there we have the wheel and that triple symbol in such very direct association with the first sermon. The turning of the wheel of the law, which makes me suspect that perhaps that symbol was used by Buddhists with very specific Buddhist meanings, which doesn't mean that, of course, other people in India didn't use it in all sorts of other ways. This is very likely. Anyway, that's nothing really to do with that. I just like it. And there we stop.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. That was really interesting and fascinating. We've got 20 minutes for a discussion of questions and so on. Sarah, you
mentioned... Yes, my question was simply that from what you said about time within the visualisation, it seemed to me that it was a kind of Sarvastivadin slant to look at the temporal aspect, and I wondered if you felt that that could indicate more of a Sarvastivadin origin. Or would there be a lot about time in early Mahayana? It's about this thing about the past, the present, and the future, visualising the past, the present, and the future. That to me sounded a little bit more...
It doesn't have the specific Sarvastivadin doctrine that you're referring to, that all exists. Past, present, and future all exist.
But might it indicate some sort of bias in that direction?
Might.
Yeah.
I think there are much stronger reasons to connect it with Sarvastivada. There are a number of... the cosmology, for example. It's in a form that we know from the Sarvastivadins. Mm. It differs a little bit from the one we would know from Theravada. In details. The problem all the time is we know quite a lot about the Sarvastivada. We know there are a number of other schools that existed in the same neighbourhood, which were in the beginning perhaps just as numerous, and they probably had rather similar doctrines in some areas than Sarvastivadins, maybe even identical ones. So you can't be completely sure that just because we only know a technical term from the Sarvastivada, it was actually exclusive to them. It may have been used by all schools in the Northwest. That wouldn't be particularly surprising.
But
so we have to be a bit careful there on these identifications.
But that preoccupation with time just seemed, the phrasing...
It would, but it's not very strong. It's there, but there are a few examples of it, but that's all. And, of course, the preoccupation with time goes straight back to the Mahapadana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, where you have the past Buddhas and the future Buddhas. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea of having past Buddhas and future Buddhas, I mean, that's pan-Buddhist. So that already gives you a temporal idea and an idea that time in somehow repeats.
Mm.
And that idea is there from a very early date. And shared with the giants too. Mm. Mm.
As you know, I've had many conversations with you. I've long had this sneaking suspicion that what we call the Vajrayana or the Tantra practiced in Buddhism and the Mahayana, there's very little to separate the two. They just really blur together. You can choose a few characteristics or features to try and give some definition to the difference, but you really have a hard time to find a line between them. They're so similar, and still people talk as though the two are different. When I hear you speak, I have a very hard time distinguishing between the Shravakayana and the Mahayana, which means that all of them really do exist on a continuum or a spectrum. The difficulty is not just so that I can get my mind around the differences, you separate them and say this is this and this is that. The difficulty is to conceive of something that was actually the source of we are not you, you are not us, the source of some kind of social or actual on-the-ground distinctions, saying, you stay there, we stay here. Why separate? Why distinguish ourselves from you? It's an open question in my mind. What would be the source of that distinction? But one of the things you said in the text just jumped out at me. I wanted to make the point, and I've said it to you privately, but the respect for arhats being present. I've been looking at a very late, very classic, very influential Vajrayana writer who really creates Vajrayana notions, who's incredibly respectful of arhats. And he writes predominantly on Mahayana theory and Vajrayana theory. And he has... So what I'm seeing there is all three stacked up. And the difference with him is that he's taken a standpoint, which is what we would call the Yogacara standpoint. Which, of course, Yogacara is very close to the yoga schools in the non-Buddhist traditions, and they have so many sort of ways of speaking about things that are so similar. But when he outlined, or he kind of looks at the perspective, he's looking from his Yogacara view, and I've begun to suspect that what we have been led to believe is the Mahayana, these distinctions, were actually something that existed outside of the Yogacara or outside of the mainstream Buddhist sects, if you will. Sect is the wrong word, their school. That it's more of a later Madhyamaka distinction to say we are Mahayana, you are Shravakayana, you are Vajrayana. These distinctions, and those don't seem to be terribly present on the ground in India, or at least not dominating.
We know so very little about the history of Buddhism, and not that much about the history of anything else in the first half of the first millennium AD in India. And, we just don't know. What we can say is that there was definite conflict, according to the Chinese sources, in Central Asia between Mahayana and non-Mahayana around the 3rd century AD. And we have the same account from the Sinhalese in Sri Lanka for the same period. And this seems to me that this is what you would expect. A tradition seeks to establish its identity. It's formulating itself. It's synthesizing different things to establish a position. And that will bring it into conflict with earlier methods and systems and established monasteries and so on and so forth. You will get, once that kind of formulation happens, you will get conflict, which you wouldn't get in the forest where people are meditating. They just discuss their different views, and there wouldn't be a reason to have a conflict of that kind. But conflicts develop. And then what you see later on is what you'd also expect, that people harmonize it all. And they learn to live together. An obvious illustration of this. If you go back just three centuries, what were Catholics and Protestants doing to one another around here? Well, there weren't any Catholics around here. They weren't let in. But you know what I mean, yeah? And yet now they are, on the whole, managing to live together relatively well. And that's just a small period of three centuries. And in fact, it happened within a shorter period than that. And this kind of variation, I'm sure, was going on in India. The relations between different religious traditions, different groups change a lot over time, both directions probably, and they are different in different places and different areas all the time. And because we have so little information, we tend to homogenize everything. This isn't like that, in actual fact. There was variation all the time. You know, we just don't have the information. Yeah? If that covers my point or not. My take on it, anyway, if you've anyway heard before.
Would the text be like a manual that people would read and sit and practice and then read and, I haven't done that bit right, or I'll look at a check to see if I'm doing it correctly, sort of thing? Would it be something that people would...
It's certainly presented as a set of instructions as to what would happen. As if it's something you should do. Of course, that could be a literary convention, perhaps. But it only gives the impression that this is something for you to do. And you could very easily see, and you could see where Yamabe makes various points, and he has valid points. You can well see that this kind of practice would lead easily into the visualization, or merge with the visualization traditions that are very strong in some sections of early Chinese Mahayana Buddhism. That's a question about that. And presumably come from India, or at least from Central Asia.
And do they also employ, what interested me, that the loathsome objects were first, which is not an obvious choice for your first choice of meditation object. And I wondered if that was to do with the fact that it was a visualization, whether in some way you had to start with something a bit unpleasant first. Because it struck me, if you were writing a meditation manual, would you start with the loathsome? I don't know, but it struck me as odd, and I wondered if perhaps that
was
to do with...
It might be a good way of keeping your monks in the order.
but then the fact that you go into the visual, whether the fact that it is a visualization manual...
This actually came up in the lectures that Florian Deliano was giving a few weeks ago. It is a quite common in Sarvastivadin related accounts for meditation on Ashubha to be presented first. Almost as if it's the most normal kind of meditation system. I mean, if you go to the Abhidharma Kosha, I mean, the one it gives, and I'm pretty sure, I think it's first there, is the one about visualizing the parts of the body until you can see the skeleton. And then you actually do, and you can see how it relates to this. And this is in the Abhidharma Kosha of Bodhisattva, sort of central text for Acharya, at any rate. But I take it he's just following the Vaibhashika tradition on this. There are other texts that give you reason to think that. So you can reduce it to the skeleton. You can go outwards, and I always find this quite fun, actually, to try. Sort of you find yourself, now you're in a room with skeletons sitting around discussing visualization meditation. See, everybody always laughs when you do that. Then you have all these skeletons wandering through Oxford. Have you ever thought about that? Look for these skeletons wandering through Oxford.
The skeleton in itself is not an unpleasant subject. It's the decay that goes... I mean, if you just see a clean skeleton,
yes,
it's not alarming.
But this is how they take it, you see.
Yes.
You can take it to the repulsive, but that's only one way to take it. So you take it to that, and then you bring it back to the body after they've taken it out. But you see the parallel to the kind of thing I've been talking about. You bring it back to the body, and they actually reduce it, and they finally end up with just the top part of the skull, and just focus into one pointedness on that whiteness. And you see, it's not actually all that repulsive. And this is the point I'm trying to make, that it may depend on how it's done. It certainly generates a lot of energy.
And it's no more surprising in one way than starting with dukkha in the Four Noble Truths. Isn't it? I mean, that's similarly, would you start with
that's right.
A negative way,
it's good points. Yes, yeah. Good points. Good
points. Well, that is the Buddhist tradition, isn't it? To start with the negative and go to the positive.
Certainly, in your the descriptions of this text, all this sort of flowing milk and so on. I mean, it reminded me of much later traditions. There's this giant, there's something to be reading at the moment, this temperature. Vaishnava text, and you visualise the body as an ocean of milk at the navel, and the lotus going out of it, and so on, and the heart.
And I haven't come across
the lion that comes out of the lotus. Mm. Mm. Another one where a Buddhist purification of the body, you visualise an ocean of milk, where you burn your body from the big toe, actually.
That would be a lot later, would it, or not?
It's about a probably about 10th century, probably.
Oh, we're quite a lot later than this.
Then all the ashes of which is your body is washed away by a milky ocean, which floods.
That's very much the sort of thing that's going on here. You know, it's doing that sort of visualisation.
Yeah. So it's interesting history, though, isn't it?
Oh, I suspect so. I suspect that there must have been many different manuals of this kind of thing, in which we just by chance this one survived. You see, there's no translation into Chinese, and yet there were lots of copies of it in Central Asia, not that far, in part of Central Asia that was under Chinese rule at various times and so on.
Well, yes, they weren't interested in meditation in China.
Well, they did translate it, and they became then interested in the more specific Mahayana visualization literature. That might be a guess. Mm. So it became outdated. It's not that there isn't visualization, I mean, I don't know Chinese, but I'm going by what I'm told, that there's plenty of visualization material in Chinese Buddhist literature. And of course, we were talking the other day, in Taoist literature as well, and there's an interconnection between some Taoist meditation traditions of some kind, clearly, in China. Make life even more complicated.
It's very interesting. I mean, why is all this, all these elaborate systems? Are they coming out of people's experiences, or are they? And if they're not, if they're constructions or visualizations or imaginations, well, I can't quite see the purpose of them really. Is it the symbolism, or?
I think it releases something.
Mm.
I mean, there's no answer from a scholarly point of view, but. From a meditation point of view, I think that it's your meditation shouldn't only affect your daily life, you know. And I mean, how much of one's life does one spend dreaming? Mm. Isn't that an important part of one's life too?
Yeah.
No? Shouldn't the meditation practice be affecting one's dream world?
What do you mean by dream? Daydreaming or dreaming when asleep?
Both. And active forms of dreaming which are as vivid as nighttime dreaming can be, that might occur at times in the day as well. You know, we like to have, we don't feel safe if there aren't clear boundaries between sleep and waking and so on. But for meditators, it may come. For some meditators, maybe they have to experience this kind of thing very vividly and allow the visual area of the mind that goes on in dreaming, allow it a lot of free play and learn how to structure, you might say learn how to structure their unconscious in accordance with principles.
But if you're not, as it were, in meditation, daydreaming, but more being more fully alert and awake.
Mm.
And how does that feel?
Well, what about lucid dreaming, you see? The whole phenomenon is much studied nowadays in the sciences, of course.
Lucid
dreaming is when you are aware of the fact that you are dreaming while you are dreaming. Yeah. And this is there's quite a lot of scientific study on this now.
The majority of people don't remember.
No, but most people can be trained to do it. Both by scientific means, and I learned long ago, met this, you know, any kind of occult groups standardly trained people to do this kind of thing.
You can actually buy a thing, like a night goggles that you put on, and it flashes to sort of
enough to wake you up partially whilst you're training yourself to disagree.
That's right. Yes, of course, you would be familiar with this area, wouldn't you? it actually came up in the thing on Buddhism and science. It came up as a part of the sort of topic. I met a bit in China who argued that by definition you can't have lucid dreaming. When you have lucid dreaming, you are dreaming that you are lucid dreaming. I couldn't quite see how to answer this. I mean, it didn't seem to me to be a very useful point of the day.
Well, you could be aware that you're asleep most of the time, couldn't you?
All too often, guys.
All too often. Well, we have to end now, unfortunately, but that was really fascinating. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us, guys. And our next one is on the 5th of November, when Rembert Leuchterhorn, such a Rembert Leuchterhorn who is sitting over there, will be speaking on Rupa Goswami in, I can't remember the title, but you can't remember either.
Tasting God, the Ascetic, Cool and Mystical Theology of Rupa Goswami. And,